Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Reversing Hashimoto's. I am your show host, Dr. Anshul Gupta, world's Hashimoto's experts. I help people reverse their Hashimoto's by making personalized functional medicine plans. And we're really excited today for a great discussion because a lot of Hashimoto's patients do suffer from several hormonal imbalances, especially PCOS. So we have a great expert, you know, who is going to talk about the connection between Hashimoto's and PCOS and infertility and all those things. So before we delve into the discussion, let me introduce you to our speaker. So our speaker is Dr. Umatma. She is a double board certified in naturopathic endocrinology in practice for over 15 years. She specializes in fertility and is a best-selling author of two books, Fertility Secrets, What Your Doctor Didn't Tell You About Baby Making, and Infertility, Struggles, Secrets, and Successes. Dr. Umatma has been awarded the Best Naturopathic Medicine Doctor Award, recognized as a top woman in medicine doctor, and joined the Berkeley Hall of Fame for continued recognition in her field. Dr. Umatma supports badass power couples to create the family of their dreams and also trains doctors who want to specialize in fertility. She's on a mission to help bring healthier babies into the world by creating healthier parents and the planet. Dr. Umatma has been featured as a holistic fertility expert on ABC, Fox, CBS, KTLA, MindBodyGreen, The Bump, and more, along with being interviewed for countless podcasts on topics of fertility, pregnancy, and postpartum health. Dr. Umatma, welcome to the show over here.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Gupta. Very excited to be here.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, like the work that you're doing is so phenomenal. And I'm really excited to talk about PCOS and Hashimoto. So why don't we actually start with, you know, like this discussion about how both of them are connected, how Hashimoto's is correlated to PCOS?
Yeah, so Hashimoto's is a very interesting condition that has the root cause in essentially like antibodies are attacking the thyroid, but underneath the surface, there's a whole host of things that are contributing to this place where the thyroid is being attacked. So the root causes, the things that are happening under the surface with Hashimoto's, also correlate to PCOS. So things like food sensitivities, which is like immune system dysfunction in the gut, basically. When that dysfunction is happening, it contributes to the immune system going haywire and then commonly attacking the thyroid. Now, similarly, in PCOS, we see a similar immune system dysfunction in the gut for women that also have PCOS. So often what we see is like women will have Hashimoto's, but it's not been uncovered yet. It's not been diagnosed, or doctors don't really know to test for the antibodies. And then that goes on for several years, by which time they've also developed PCOS. Now, vice versa, sometimes women, there are a lot of young women that have PCOS, they're put on birth control, so they think that it's handled, but the underlying thing still exists and then is creating Hashimoto's. So it can really go either way. And I think that the connection point is really what's happening under the surface.
Absolutely. I think that is so important, like looking at those root causes and what is happening inside. But the interesting part, what you shared was that, you know, the PCOS can have an immune connection. Right. Most of the people would be thinking that PCOS is just a hormonal imbalances, right? So tell us more about it, like, you know, why you call it as an immune dysfunction and why, like, you know, conventional doctors are just looking at the hormonal imbalance piece.
Well, PCOS is actually, there are a lot of things that can contribute to PCOS. So the gut immune dysfunction, or food sensitivities, if we want to simplify it, food sensitivities are really, really common in women with PCOS. So it's not necessarily like, hey, this is a cause of PCOS. We're just going to see that the immune system in the gut is not functioning very well. There's kind of a, I think of it as like a declined barrier, right? So your warriors in the gut are not working as well as they should. They're not as strong as they should be, and their defenses are a little bit lowered. Now, that leaves women vulnerable to all kinds of things. But those warriors that we need in our gut are going to then drive inflammation, because immune system dysfunction is going to lead to inflammation. Inflammation is directly related to PCOS in many women. The gut dysfunction, if you're not absorbing nutrients properly, is going to lead to hormonal imbalances. You can also have in PCOS insulin resistance. That's a really common underlying cause. So insulin resistant driven PCOS will maybe have gut imbalances, but then we have this other layer of like immune, insulin, pancreas not working properly. And that insulin resistance then goes and causes anovulation and dysfunction in the hormones. So all of these different types of underlying things can lead to PCOS. In the case of women that overlap Hashimoto's and PCOS, they have both discovered or not, they are going to have that like immune system dysfunction kind of driving both of the conditions. So it's not that PCOS always has gut dysfunction, but in the women that have that gut immune dysfunction, you're more likely going to see PCOS and Hashimoto's coexisting and kind of feeding off of each other, right? So the other piece of this that I forgot to mention is really when the thyroid is not functioning well, or maybe even the thyroid is functioning. TSH looks normal, T3, T4 are sustaining, but there are antibodies to the thyroid. Now these warriors, the defense system in the gut is depleted, yet the rest of the body is overactivated. So there's all these warriors walking around and like, oh, attack, attack. And they're attacking the thyroid when they shouldn't be. And that, like, over time, on average, it takes 7 years for these antibodies to destroy the tissue to the point where you will actually see hormonal imbalance. However, that destruction that's happening on a low grade is also causing like depleted function of the thyroid, which then we know has a direct impact on the ovaries. So then the ovaries are not as responsive. Thyroid has T4, which is the inactive hormone, T3, which we consider active hormone, and then T2, which is the final end product that actually influences the ovaries. So we have receptors on the ovaries for T2. We don't know exactly why or what it does yet, but we know that we have this receptor. So there's a direct connection between thyroid and ovaries. So if the ovaries, like the body's sustaining, it's got enough T3 and T4 to sustain, you don't have a lot of symptoms, you're not fatigued, you're not seeing hair loss, you may not see a lot of symptoms, but it's not enough to get all the way to T2 and the ovaries are dysfunctioning. So you'll see sometimes this like PCOS-like picture where anovulation is an issue or late ovulation, like women are ovulating till much later in their menstrual month. But it's because they're not getting that signal from the thyroid to actually do it, to do their job, right? So you're seeing hormonal dysfunction that sometimes even looks like PCOS and may not be classical PCOS that really is stemming from the thyroid.
So that is very interesting. So when you say that is not classical PCOS, that means that sometimes their hormonal blood work might not be so abnormal and they still can have PCOS?
Well, no. So they have like PCOS-like patterns, which is basically like late ovulation or anovulation. They have maybe irregular cycles. They have potentially like cramps or kind of pain with ovulation or menstruation. Those are going to be like sometimes no one, you can't diagnose PCOS based off of that. But someone might say, oh, you have your regular periods. Oh, your testosterone is high. Oh, you have insulin resistance. But when we really look at the full picture and we see like, oh, there's antibodies to the thyroid, that's going to now influence how the ovaries are functioning. And are they regularly functioning with their hormone balance? Or is it skewed one side or the other? And that will often link back to the thyroid. So that's what I mean when I say like not classical PCOS, in the sense of they don't meet the they don't meet all the criteria for PCOS. But you look at them and you say, you still have irregular periods. You still are not ovulating. So even though you don't technically have PCOS, some of the things that we're going to use to support your body to get back to a regular cycle and have more balance in hormones is really going to be to address that Hashimoto's piece.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you mentioned about these underlying causes, you know, which are causing PCOS, and you mentioned obviously food sensitivities or gut issues as, you know, being one of those. What are the other common causes which can cause PCOS?
Yeah, there is the insulin resistance. That's a big, big, big one. I think that I would say 60, 70% of women with PCOS are going to have some level of insulin resistance. And that's usually what's going to cause that like abdominal obesity, really difficult to lose weight. They're like, I do all the right workouts, I eat all the right food, I still can't lose weight, right? So those are going to be, those women often have insulin resistance. And then inflammation is a really big driver, as we know, for all diseases. But in the case of PCOS, we can actually see high levels of inflammation in the body. Even a simple like hsCRP, C-reactive protein, is going to be more likely than not going to be elevated. And we're going to see that inflammation is kind of throughout the body. There is a third type, which is basically post-pill PCOS. So that type of PCOS is specific to dysfunction based on someone being put on birth control. So maybe someone started like just wanting some protection, like, hey, I'm 14, I don't want to have a child yet. Or parents say, get on birth control, we're not taking any chances. But when they get off of birth control, maybe 10, 15, 20 years later, their hormones are very much out of whack and really have this like PCOS type picture. Again, they have all of the symptoms, they even meet the criteria for PCOS, but it's driven by the fact that their hormonal system has kind of been shut down for 10, 15 years. So it never really like had a full chance to develop. And then that causes the anovulation, irregular menstrual cycle, hormonal imbalance, all of the things that go along with PCOS.
Absolutely. So, I mean, multiple causes are there. So it's just not one thing which leads to PCOS. It's a combination of multiple things and underlying problems that ultimately comes out as PCOS then.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I was, the other thing that I think with Hashimoto's and PCOS, when we think about like, what is the correlation? Like, why is there so much overlap? The other thing is toxins. Toxins are going to affect the thyroid very much. And toxins are connected with PCOS. There's a lot of connection with things like BPA, bisphenol, what is it? Bisphenol phosphates, BPA. I forget what it stands for. I can't remember the A. It's those mimickers of estrogen are going to cause dysfunction. They're going to essentially create imbalances that look like estrogen dominance and not having the right like pathways functioning to metabolize estrogen in and out of the body. And they are impacting the ovaries. They're impacting how well the body is able to regulate and cycle and have hormonal balance. So these, like, I remembered bisphenol A. It doesn't stand for anything. Bisphenol A is essentially going to, or compounds like it. So there's BPS, BPF, there's a bunch of them. We just know the most about BPA. They are going to create issues with women's menstruation, hormonal cycles, but also impact negatively the thyroid. So there's BPA is a big one. Phthalates are a big one. Fragrances are a big one. These are going to be toxins that impact both the ovaries and the thyroid similarly.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, whenever somebody comes with you, let's say we have both Hashimoto's and PCOS, what is kind of the approach? Because obviously there's so many causes. How can one figure out what is the, like, underlying root causes for their problems? Do you rely a lot on testing, or you rely on mainly your clinical expertise, or you use both?
Really both, right? Like, the clinical expertise is great because we might see someone start talking to them and like, oh, this is what I had this person, exact same pattern. Everything was the same. We tested them for this. We figured out this, right? So it, like, having someone that has had experience is going to have the advantage of like a faster time to uncovering what's happening under the surface. But I'm a big proponent for testing, right? Like, we can guess all we want, but if we don't know for sure, then we're still guessing. And I like to see the proof, because when we start out, we want to make sure that not only do we fully understand all of the underlying things, we also understand, and that drives some of our strategies. So it's not like, hey, you have PCOS and Hashimoto's, we always give them this thing and it always works. It's actually like, okay, you have Hashimoto's and you have this specific type of PCOS. We need to approach your care in a specific way that's going to be different and unique to you than someone else. So really, that testing is going to help drive or guide our strategy that we're going to use to help bring balance and get them to the point of hopefully being able to have a baby and carry to term, which is essentially what people want to work with us for.
Agreed. I also am a big proponent that, you know, you need to test. Until you're going to test, you're not going to know exactly where the root cause is. Yes, yeah. You can always recommend, just generalize recommendations for a healthy lifestyle. But to be more specific than that, you know, testing is absolutely necessary. So I'm glad that you're also doing those advanced testing so people can know exactly their root causes.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think with PCOS especially, so important, because it's often assumed that PCOS is estrogen dominant condition, right? Like, that estrogen is driving that issue. What we see in testing is actually a whole different picture. And very often I find that estrogen's not actually elevated. Some of them have no estrogen, but are likely to have all of the symptoms of estrogen dominant, I believe, from the toxins that are in their bodies, right? So their level of toxin burden is high. Maybe their liver is not processing the toxins out of their system very well. Then you have, are we thinking about drainage pathways, for example? Like, is their lymph moving and flowing enough to actually get those toxins out of the different areas that it can stagnate? And the pelvis is one of those places where it can stagnate. So if the toxins are not moving out properly, they are kind of pooling in the pelvis because we sit in an L shape all day long. It's essentially like right at the pelvis. We're not getting the movement and the flow to actually move that stuff out. Then the ovaries are soaking this in and are like, well, I guess I have estrogens. All the receptors are bound. These estrogen mimickers will essentially bind to the receptors, but have no real action like estrogen, right? So when we actually test people, their labs will maybe show a very different picture than what we assume or think based on their symptoms. So I find that like, especially with PCOS, that's so true very often. It's like, oh, we're just gonna, you know, we're assuming you're estrogen dominant. We're gonna give you all these supplements. And in reality, it's a completely different picture under the surface.
Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously people want to know like what they can do, right? So let's say they have Hashimoto's and PCOS and they want to have a baby. So what are the things that you will recommend, or maybe some generalized recommendation that can be useful or implement in everyone?
Yeah. So I do have some favorites. My favorite for Hashimoto's, which has potentially benefit to PCOS women as well, is black cumin seed oil. It is one of the fastest ways to decrease inflammation, to decrease antibodies. The research on it is phenomenal. So that's probably one of the top things that I'm considering. Like, hey, does it make sense to put this person on black cumin seed oil? The second, what we'll use often, and I'll just give you like the things that overlap because they're going to have benefit to both. The second one is going to be myo-inositol. Myo-inositol has an impact on supporting women that maybe have insulin resistance. So they have that like insulin resistant type of PCOS. It's going to help double blind placebo controlled studies with metformin and myo-inositol showed that myo-inositol was just as effective. There were further studies that said, what happens if we can combine myo-inositol and berberine? And they found that those two combined together worked phenomenally better than metformin. So for all the women that are on metformin because they have PCOS and insulin resistance and still not getting better most of the time, switching them potentially to something like myo-inositol and berberine is going to have a way better impact and get at some of the root causes. Berberine is another one of my favorites because it will support the healing of the gut. So then you think about like, oh, there's probably microbiome imbalance, that microbes in our gut are sometimes the first responders for our immune system, right? So if we don't have the right microbes, we maybe have candida, we maybe have some dysbiosis in the gut that's going to create an environment that immune dysfunction prevails. Right. And berberine is going to kill those microbes. So now not only are you getting insulin resistance benefits, you're improving the gut microbiome, which then has the impact of helping to improve gut immunity and eventually inflammation. So myo-inositol and berberine. And then things like glutathione, which are going to be great for egg quality. They're going to support the antibodies and inflammation for the thyroid. So those are going to be... glutathione can be a great support. And then things like NAC. NAC is a precursor to glutathione. That's going to help support the production of glutathione, but NAC on its own has benefits of antioxidant, immune support, anti-inflammatory, but could potentially very much support PCOS women. So that one is going to be potentially a good one as well.
Awesome. Let's talk about a little bit about the diet piece also, because you know, everybody's kind of, you know, doing a different kind of diet. Some people feel an AIP diet is good. Some people are doing a plant-based diet. Some people are going all the way to a ketogenic diet. And obviously the new diet is a carnivore diet that a lot of people are trying. So for the PCOS piece of it, especially, like, what do you feel, you know, the research suggests, which might be the best diet according to you?
Honestly, I am a big fan of customization. So I don't believe in any diet, none whatsoever. I have my personal choices of diet. That's a personal choice, but even what I follow, I don't impose that on anyone else. I truly, truly, truly believe that every single person is different. Our guts are different. The microbes in our gut are different. Our genetics is different. Like, what our ancestors ate is going to have an impact on what we can and cannot consume. So for me, I would say the biggest starting point that I think all diets agree on is the removing of processed food, removing of vegetable oils like canola and palm oil and things like that. The kind of elimination of common sensitivities is usually a good starting point. So corn, dairy, gluten, soy potentially for some people, and sugar. Those five, removing those is going to create lowered inflammation for everyone across the board. So there are, I think there are some things that everyone can agree on. And for the rest of it, it's really like, how is this going to work for you in your body? If someone has insulin resistance, for example, we'll sometimes put CGMs on people. So continuous glucose monitor, especially if they have PCOS that's insulin resistant. We want to know exactly what foods are driving this PCOS, right? Like, why do you have this? Why is it insulin resistance? And they often are like, but I eat so healthy. Like, okay, no problem. Let's just figure it out. And something as simple as not getting a proper night's sleep the night before will throw off our insulin balance through the entire course of the next day. So if we find out that, hey, you didn't sleep very well, and that's why you're insulin resistant, and we know that PCOS, there's a big component, we didn't even get into the melatonin piece. So there's a component where PCOS women are potentially going to have dysregulation of melatonin and cortisol. And if their cortisol and melatonin are dysregulated, they basically, I call it a sleep-wake cycle imbalance, right? They're wanting to sleep when they're awake, and they're awake when they should be sleeping. If that is happening, the lack of melatonin and the lack of good quality sleep is going to drive insulin resistance. So we really have to think about, when we think about food or diet, it's, what is our goal? Is our goal to promote a diet, or is our goal to say, hey, you as an individual have all of these food sensitivities, or you as an individual really, like, yes, you eat great, but your insulin resistance has nothing to do with the food you're eating. It has to do with the lack of sleep. So let's just work on that. So really taking a step back and saying, what's driving this? And what is the way I think about it is like, what's the lowest hanging fruit? What's the strategy that is going to shift all these things simultaneously by doing this one little thing? Like, if we can just get you to sleep 9 hours instead of five, and you sleep through the night, you get good, better quality sleep. And honestly, like, there's ways to biohack that, right? Like, oh, I can't sleep at night. Okay, well, let's see what you ate the evening before. Often they're eating late. They didn't chew their food properly. They had dinner in front of the TV. They literally like had a bunch of protein, and protein will kind of like upregulate our need to digest and not sleep, right? So it throws off like the quality of sleep that we get that night. So all of these factors, that like little micro change, instead of like, hey, I'm going to just throw away all the stuff you're eating and you're going to eat all this and it's going to be so limited. It's like, if we just go about it a different way, if we think about food as, yes, like it's essential, and the diversity is essential. So when we take away whole food groups, like, and the carnivore diet is probably my favorite to pick on, because like, I just don't get it. I like, no amount of like just eating meat is going to fix all of your problems. It's like, it may fix it temporarily. And all diets work temporarily, right? Like, you go on any diet, it doesn't matter what it is, it's going to work temporarily, because your body is like, oh, something new, something to adjust to, something to like feel different about. But the reality is, what's the sustaining aspect of that diet? Is it actually going to be long lasting, or are the effects going to go away and then you're going to have all the negative effects? Which, like, carnivore diet is going to feed inflammation. Like, we already know this. How much research do we have on meat being inflammatory? So let's just eat meat and take out vegetables. We kill all the microbes in our gut because microbes are fed by fiber, essentially. So, like, it's a little bit of like a big question mark for me of like, how do we come up with these diets? And then we're promoting them to people, and they may have very limited clinical use. There may be the person that absolutely needs a carnivore diet for a period of time while you work on some other things. But fundamentally, like, that's not a diet that people should stay on long term. The other question that comes up a lot with food and PCOS especially is intermittent fasting. And for PCOS specifically, so this is not if you're trying to get pregnant, but if you have PCOS, that is insulin resistant driven PCOS, then intermittent fasting for short periods of time is extremely effective because it will help to reset the metabolism in a way that is going to support rebalancing. But it needs to be done very carefully. Someone needs to be monitoring this. It's not a, oh, I have PCOS, so I should just intermittent fast and do that for 4 years, and then you'll be in my office because you're like, my hormones are out of whack and I'm trying to get pregnant now, right? So don't do the fasting if you're trying to get pregnant. But if you are in that place of like, gosh, I really can't lose weight, this insulin resistance is crazy, for a short period of time, like 2-3 months, it's fine to do some intermittent fasting, help reset the metabolism. Even something more extreme like the fasting mimicking diet, for example, could be a good way to reset the metabolism. But then you need to figure out what's going to be next, because that's not going to be a long-term solution. That's a very short-term fix to help drive results. And then you're like, okay, now what? I've had that new place. Now what? So just really thinking about food from a place of individualism, holism. If I tell someone, hey, you should eat more of this particular food group, what impact is it going to have? And is that impact something that's going to support the whole body, or is it going to support just a tiny portion of what the body is doing and potentially put it in a more stressed out place, which then makes a lot of things worse?
Absolutely. I think that makes perfect sense. You know, I think we are looking at like a one diet that is going to fit everyone. And when you said correctly that it has to be individualized, and I am totally on board with those extreme diets. I totally believe that extreme diets cannot be useful for long-term basis, maybe for short-term, as you suggested. So yeah. I'm glad that, you know, you're able to kind of again talk about the diet in so much detail in a very different perspective, you know, I must say. Because again, everybody's talking about food groups or in macros and things, but nobody's talking about, okay, well, what your body needs and what are you trying to achieve with that diet is very important. So I'm glad that, you know, you picked on all of those different aspects. So I think we covered a lot of things: intermittent fasting, the diet, the supplements, the sleep, the melatonin connection. I'm glad that people have so many things that they can do now that will be helpful for their PCOS. So tell us more about like where people can find you. And I think you have a free ebook for people to download to get more information. So tell us more about all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So my ebook is called, I'm going to actually just show it. This is the old cover. We have a new cover coming. The Holistic Fertility Blueprint. And it is the guide to fertility from a holistic perspective. What are the root causes? Because we talked a lot about root causes of PCOS and Hashimoto's today. But in general, with fertility, I think a lot of people think of that as the disease. Oh, I'm infertile. I'm like, no, you're not infertile. Unless you have a genetic disorder or physical anomaly that's causing infertility, you're not infertile. So fertility then is like a sixth vital sign in some ways. It's a sign or a symptom of something much deeper that if we start kind of changing the conversation around, like, is this a disease or is this a symptom that you're experiencing? When we ask the questions about symptoms, we get very different answers about what we can do for fertility. So similar to PCOS, I think it's really this, like, what's happening under the surface and how do we go about it from the individual in front of us rather than some protocol that may or may not work. conventional and functional. There are lots of people out there with, like, oh, this is my fertility detox or this is my protocol for fertility. Instead of that, just really thinking about, well, what is it for me? What is my body doing and why is it telling me that I can't get pregnant? And those tend to give us very different answers. So that's what's in the ebook. And we will share the link for the ebook and then people can find me at holisticfertilityinstitute.com or on Instagram at holisticfertilitydoctor.
Absolutely. Great. People, please, we are going to put all of these links in the description. Go check out the ebook. That is a wealth of knowledge. You know, like, you have to have that understanding, you know, about what is happening in your body. And I think that ebook is going to give you a lot of answers. And follow her on these various channels. And obviously, like, if you have issues, please reach out to her. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Omatma, again, coming over here. That was a great information session that we had today. Thank you for so much for sharing all the information.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Dr. Gupta.
All right, guys, that's it for today. Thank you so much again for joining us.